Hello, this is Linda Landrigan, editor of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. In this new installment of AHMM's podcast series, Steve Hawkinsmith reads The MacGuffin Theft Case, which appeared in our November 2005 issue. Steve's first mystery story, Erie's Last Day, was published in Hitchcock in 2000 and won a Derringer Award from the Short Mystery Fiction Society. The fifth novel in his Homes of the Range series, World's Greatest Detective, was published in January 2011. He is also the author of the horror Regency mashup Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, Dawn of the Dreadfuls, and he has published an ebook collection of his holiday mysteries, Naughty, Nine Tales of Christmas Crime. Here is Steve Hawkinsmith reading The MacGuffin Theft Case.
The MacGuffin Theft Case by Steve Hawkinsmith. Bert was 20 minutes late for lunch, but it couldn't be helped. He'd been marked for death by a Yakuza kingpin, and it had taken him all morning to eradicate the latest team of ninjas sent to do him in. When Bert finally limped into Luigi's Slice-O-Heaven pizza parlor, his friend Raymond didn't bother asking about his tardiness. He didn't even ask why Bert had blood on his clothes, nunchucks in his hands, and a poisoned dart sticking out of his artificial leg. Raymond never asked questions. Raymond provided answers, usually to questions that hadn't been asked. An overturned shaker of salt might inspire a 5-minute lecture about the medieval spice trade, leading into a 10-minute lecture about why the game Marco Polo isn't an Olympic sport, leading into a 15-minute lecture about the 1980 Bruce Jenner Village People disco musical Can't Stop the Music. Raymond's stream of consciousness was a roaring river capable of sweeping away anyone within earshot. When Bert walked into the restaurant, Raymond was exhaustively explaining the difference between farther and further to a desperate-looking waitress who was slowly inching farther from the table, mumbling, "Yeah, uh-huh, all right, gotta go, uh-huh, well, work to do, uh-huh." "Hello, Ray," Bert said. "Sorry I'm late." Raymond turned toward his friend, and the waitress shot away from the table like the cork from a bottle of champagne. "Better late than never," Raymond said, as Bert dropped wearily into the seat across from him. "Do you know who first said that? Herodotus of Halicarnassus, the ancient historian. Some say he was talking about the Greeks' victory over Xerxes at Mycale, which finally stopped the expansion of the Achaemenid Empire. Others speculate that he was referring to a plate of feta cheese that was brought to him just as he was about to pass out from hunger while completing Book 9 of the Histories in 430 BC. Did you know you can make feta in your bathtub? All it takes is some milk, the right yeast culture, a lot of brine, and a little patience." Raymond went on to explain the feta-making process while Bert reset the shoulder he'd dislocated while dispatching a particularly deadly ninja in hand-to-hand combat just minutes before. The pain of popping the shoulder back into place made Bert swoon, but even when his face dropped within inches of the red and white checkered tablecloth, Raymond didn't slow down. "If you don't have yeast," Raymond was saying, "just throw in a loaf of Wonder Bread. The yeast cultures in underbaked white bread are still active enough to serve as a coagulant in milk. You might have to keep the feta in your tub an extra week or two, but it'll come out tasting wonderful." Somehow, Raymond managed to lick his lips and kiss his fingertips and rub his tummy all at the same time. But Bert didn't plan on trying Raymond's feta recipe anytime soon. His wife surely wouldn't appreciate a bathtub full of milk, bread, and brine, and she was already pretty steamed about all the dead ninjas around the house. And there was another equally important reason Bert wouldn't be following Raymond's advice. Bert didn't believe a word Raymond said. Not that he disbelieved. Raymond wasn't a liar. He just had a way of twisting truth's arm until it screamed, "Uncle!" "So," Bert said, picking up a menu. That was as far as he got. "I already ordered for us," Raymond cut in. "There's only one thing to get at Luigi's Slice-O-Heaven. Did you know this is the last pizza parlor in the state that still serves Pizza Classico?" "Pizza?" Bert began. "Classico. Old-school pizza. The kind you could get back in the day, before pizza lost its edge. You mean you don't know the story?" Before Bert could even draw a breath to answer, Raymond was spinning his tail. Bert didn't mind. He was bruised and bloodied and bone-tired, in no shape to keep up his end of a real conversation, which made Raymond the perfect person to be with. Bert wouldn't even have to bother with the occasional nod of the head or "no way" or "then what happened?" Raymond wouldn't stop talking until his tale was told, and he wouldn't stop then either. Bert didn't even have to listen, as long as he didn't snore too loudly. He leaned back, closed his eyes, and tried not to think of ninjas. "Pizza's a lot older than most people think," Raymond said. The first Pizza Hut was an actual hut just outside the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and a mummified deep dish with pepperoni was found in King Tut's tomb, presumably because he'd need comfort food in the afterlife. But these early pizzas were different from modern za in two important respects. They were square, and they were never sliced. People simply grabbed hold, tore off a strip, rolled it up, and ate it like a burrito. Which is why the popularity of pizza dropped off considerably after Louis Pasteur started warning everybody about little invisible things called germs. Who wants to eat food that's been pawed by every person at the table? I mean, you know you washed your hands the last time you were in the bathroom, but can you be so sure about Uncle Walter? Still, pizza hung in there as a food on the wane with a small but loyal fan base, sort of like cow brain sandwiches, haggis, pop rocks, and fresh vegetables today. It didn't make its big comeback until geopolitics and crime collided to create the modern pizza pie. Here's what happened. Back in the 20s and 30s, becoming a gentleman sleuth was about the most fashionable thing you could do. If your blood ran blue, you spent your ample free time either playing polo or catching murderers. Probably the most renowned of these dilettante detectives was the brilliant amateur scientist, psychologist, art critic, winemaker, horse breeder, palm reader, lion tamer, monkey trainer, florist, philanthropist, philosopher, philatelist, Egyptologist, meteorologist, ethnomusicologist, mixologist, hairstylist, Philo Doe. Doe and his companion, wink wink, Cyrus Furman, filled an entire wing of Sing Sing with killers, cracking famous mysteries like the Purple Poodle murder case, the Spatula murder case, the Dust Bunny murder case, and the Little Piece of Felt at the End of a Pool Cue murder case. Unfortunately, World War II took the fun out of death for a lot of people, even Doe, and after working tirelessly to keep Greenwich Village free of Nazi saboteurs during the war, he and Furman slipped into quiet semi-retirement. Doe spent his days reading, writing, and cataloging his vast collections of wine, art, stamps, and hairstyling products, while Furman continued to do what he did best, look on admiringly. But duty called for Doe one last time in the spring of 1950. In the past, Doe's cases had always started the same way, with a visit from his old friend, District Attorney Dunzel. By 50, however, Dunzel was long gone, having been hounded from office after the citizens of New York finally realized the only thing he could do without Doe's help was collect a salary. It wasn't Dunzel's replacement who came to Doe hat in hand now, though. It was a much younger, leaner man with buzz-cut hair and cold eyes and a frown that looked like it had been set in cement. "My name isn't important, and you don't need to know who I work for," the man said by way of introduction when Doe met him at the door of his elegant penthouse apartment. "What is important is this. Your country needs you." "Then by all means, come in and have a seat, Mr. Hershey," Doe said, stepping aside and sweeping his arm out toward the study. "If the Central Intelligence Agency thinks I can be of some assistance, then of course I'm at your disposal." Even though Furman was in the kitchen, cutting out radish florets to adorn Doe's lunch, his unerring sidekick radar gave off a ping, and he knew the great detective had done something impressive somewhere. "Astounding, Doe," he called out reflexively. "How did you ever do it?" "Observation and analysis, Furman, nothing more," Doe called back. "On your jacket," he whispered to a glowering Hershey as the young man stepped into the apartment. Hershey looked down. Stuck to the left breast of his drab gray overcoat was a name tag. "Hi, my name is Hershey, CIA. Hershey ripped off the sticky tag and crumpled it in a curled fist. "I can't very well impress you with my genius if you don't make it hard for me," Doe said, and his thin lips pressed themselves into a prim smile. He led Hershey into the study, eased himself into one of the room's plush armchairs, and gestured at another seat nearby. Hershey glared at the chair, practically sneering at it, as if he considered sitting an affectation of the decadent in a feat. He stayed on his feet. "So," Doe said, "I infer from your name tag that you were a visitor somewhere today. A government facility, I presume. Perhaps a laboratory conducting work of vital importance to our national defense. A laboratory which has recently played host to... murder?" "Great Scott!" Furman yelled from the kitchen. "Not quite," said Hershey. "Yes, I was at a secret government lab today, and a crime was committed there. But it wasn't murder. It was theft." "Theft?" Doe said, looking slightly deflated. "My specialty is murder, you know. The ping-pong paddle murder case, the flying squirrel murder case, the unopened tube of Preparation H murder case, the..." "I know all about your career as a detective, Doe," Hershey snapped. "And believe you me, if you need deaths to pique your interest, then this could easily become the most fascinating case of your career." Doe leaned back and stroked his neatly trimmed Van Dyke. "Tell me more, Hershey," he said. "Tell me everything." "If I told you everything," Hershey replied, "I'd have to kill you." It was an old joke, even then. Only Hershey wasn't joking. "The government has secrets, and it has top secrets," the CIA agent explained. And then there are secret top secrets. Secrets so secret, even the existence of the secrecy is top secret. Of all these secrets, one is the secretest of them all. I can't confirm or deny its existence. I can't even confirm or deny that I'm having this conversation about it at this very moment. Secret? Conversation? I don't know what you're talking about. See what I mean? It's that secret. It's that explosive. It's the hydrogen bomb, Doe said. Gasp! Furman called out from the dining room where he was setting out plates. How could you possibly... Simple logic, my good fellow, simple logic, Doe shouted back. Been reading about it in the Times for months, he whispered to Hershey, who'd slipped his right hand into his coat pocket where he obviously kept something bulky and loaded with bullets. Oh, come now, Hershey, surely you wouldn't kill me for knowing too much, as they say, not when half the world knows as much as I do. We're racing against the Soviets to create the first hydrogen-fueled super bomb. That's about as secret as J. Edgar Hoover's boyfriend Clyde. J. Edgar Hoover's what? Hershey shot back, the gun in his pocket bulging ominously in Doe's direction. Never mind that, Doe said quickly, waving the matter away with a flutter of his long hands. The important thing is this. Something's been taken from a lab where scientists were working on the most powerful weapon ever devised. Please don't tell me someone's managed to steal an actual H-bomb. No, thank God, Hershey said, slowly drawing his hand from his pocket. But it's just about that bad. A prototype is almost ready for testing, and the blueprints have been stolen. Doe tried to leap to his feet, but he was pushing 70 by then, and it took him a good half minute to hoist himself from the soft cushions of his armchair. "There's no time to lose," he announced when he was finally upright. "We must go to the secret laboratory at once. It's nearby, I presume, on the campus of NYU." Hershey stuffed his hand back in his pocket. "How did you—" "Come, come, Hershey, your name tag. You could have forgotten you were wearing it long enough to travel a few blocks, but no more than that, I'm sure. And where else in Manhattan would such cutting-edge scientific research be conducted?" The lab could have been on the Columbia campus, Hershey pointed out. Yes, it could have, in which case you wouldn't have come to me. Nero Wolfe lives much closer to the Upper West Side than I do. You would have gone to him instead. A muffled cry sounded from somewhere inside the apartment. What was that, Furman? Doe called out. Sorry, old bean, just pulling your croque-monsieur out of the oven, Furman yelled back. I said, brilliant, Doe, by Jove, you never cease to amaze me. How does he do that? Hershey growled. Enough dilly-dallying, Doe announced, heading for the front door as quickly as his old legs would carry him. We've got a traitor to catch. But Doe would have to catch that traitor without any help from his sidekick. Hershey refused to let Furman come along. What's he good for anyway? Hershey asked. Far as I can see, all he does is tell you how great you are. Precisely, Doe shot back. He's indispensable. But Hershey dispensed with him anyway, and when he and Doe left, Furman was sitting alone at the dining room table, glumly munching on a radish florette. Within 15 minutes, Hershey was leading Doe down a hidden stairwell in one of NYU's most unassuming classroom buildings. When they reached the bottom, Hershey gave the wall a shave and a haircut knock. A brick in the wall slid aside, revealing a pair of steely gray eyes. Password, a gruff voice barked. Jeopardy, Hershey said. Code, Omega. Clearance. Hershey heaved an annoyed sigh. You want to know my clearance? He made a V with his fingers and poked the gray eyes Three Stooges style. Don't be a dumbass, pal. I was just here half an hour ago. Open up. The brick slid back into place, and the wall swung open on hidden hinges. Sorry, sir, can't be too careful these days, said a burly MP on the other side, rubbing his eyes. Behind him was a small table with, hi, my name is name tags, and a magic marker resting on it. Beyond that stretched a short hallway with 5 doors, 2 on each side and 1 at the end. Welcome to the Chicago Project, Hershey said. Powell, the MP, nodded at the name tags. If you wouldn't mind, sirs. Hershey ignored him. Those are offices, he said to Doe, pointing at the 2 doors on the left and the 1 at the end of the hall. The door at the far right leads to the records room where the blueprints were kept. Doe turned toward the nearest door. And what goes on in here? He was answered by the sound of flushing water. The door opened, and a stout, red-haired, heavily bearded man stepped out, wiping his hands on his kilt. This is Professor McGuffin, the project leader, Hershey said. McGuffin, this is Philo Doe.
Ah, Mr. Doe! I canna tell you what a relief it is to see you, sir. If any man canna get those plans back, it's you. Well, you are Nero Wolfe. Come back to my office here, and I'll tell you the whole story.
McGuffin's office was behind the central door at the end of the hallway. It was a small, dimly lit room packed with thick reference books and crumpled paper and broken abacuses. A caber the height and width of a man was leaning in one corner.
For when I need a wee touch of exercise, McGuffin explained.
A chalkboard dominated the far wall. It was covered with long strings of numbers and mathematical symbols. The last line was, E equals MC squared minus IQ equals 1,000 TNT to the 100th power equals boom.
You appear to be very close to your goal, Professor, Doe said.
Aye, very close. We're just weeks away from finishing the MacGuffin device."
The professor's lips twisted into a small, prideful smile. "That's what we've named the mechanism that triggers fusion. If the Ruskies get those blueprints, they'll have their own MacGuffin soon enough, and that'll give them the H-bomb within the year, I guarantee."
"When did you notice the plans were missing?"
"This morning. I went into the records room to make a few changes, and they weren't there. We checked the other offices, even the loo. The plans simply couldn't be found."
"How big are the plans?"
MacGuffin held his hands not quite 2 feet apart. "About so."
"And who had access to them?"
"All of us here in this wing of the project. Myself and my colleagues, Dr. Herring and Dr. Straw."
"This wing? You mean there's more to the Chicago project than this?"
"Oh, aye. Underneath Bronx Community College, there's a..."
Hershey jammed his hand into his coat pocket, and the resulting bulge aimed itself at Professor MacGuffin.
"Ah, I meant to say, oh no, this is it, Mr. Doe," the professor corrected himself nervously. "There is nae anyone else, and even if there were, theoretically speaking, you understand, this is the only place plans for the MacGuffin device would be stored."
"I see. So isn't it possible someone who worked here simply walked out with the plans?"
"They could try, but Powell out there searches us every time we leave. Even he searched when another soldier comes at the end of his shift. No, you couldn't have just walked out with the plans in your sock."
"Yet there were no signs of a break-in, I take it?"
"Nay, nothing." "But we do know the facility's cover's been blown," Hershey said.
Doe cocked an eyebrow. "Blown?"
"Aye, that was a surprise," MacGuffin said. "Yesterday, just before 5 p.m., Powell, the guard, he knocks on my door and he tells me there's been a pizza delivered."
Doe cocked his other eyebrow. "A pizza?"
"Aye, from Uncle Joe's pizzeria. The delivery man knocked on the wall outside our secret entrance and wouldn't go away till Powell opened up and paid him. He claimed someone inside phoned in the order."
Doe couldn't cock any more eyebrows, so he cocked an ear. "Standard KGB psyops," Hershey explained. "The Reds have phoned in fake pizza orders for the Pentagon, the Treasury, the Justice Department. They ring and run the White House about twice a month. And just last week, a Soviet mole left a flaming bag of dog poop on the Capitol steps. Of course, we run the same kinds of operations ourselves." Hershey's granite-stiff expression looked almost on the brink of breaking into a smile. "I got Stalin on the phone once. Asked him if his fridge was running."
"Yes, well, congratulations, Hershey," Doe said. He turned back to the professor.
"So you didn't actually eat any of this mystery pizza, did you?"
"Ach, that's the most fiendish thing about it," MacGuffin exclaimed. "Those Russian bastards sent us an extra large, with double anchovies and pineapple. I couldn't bring myself to so much as touch it."
"Of course," Doe said. "I only have one more question, Professor."
"Aye?"
Doe leaned forward, the intensity of his gaze pinning MacGuffin like a butterfly in a collector's case. Hershey leaned forward, too, sensing that the old detective's next words could be of literally earth-shaking importance.
"Tell me," Doe said, "were you wearing your kilt yesterday?"
MacGuffin blinked slowly, then smiled and let out a relieved sigh.
"It's easy enough to answer that, Mr. Doe. Nay, I was not. I had on my Aberdeen trousers, red with green and black checks."
"Sounds fetching," Doe said, not sounding particularly sincere. "Come along, Hershey. I'd like to speak with Professor MacGuffin's colleague, Dr. Herring."
"What was that about MacGuffin's kilt?" Hershey asked when the two of them were out in the hallway again.
"Have you no curiosity, Hershey?" Doe replied as they approached Herring's office. "Don't tell me you've never wondered what a Scotsman keeps under his kilt."
"Pervert," Hershey mumbled under his breath as Doe brought up a hand to knock on Herring's door.
"There's nothing perverse about it," said Doe, who had sharper hearing than Hershey thought. "If you'd give a moment's thought to—" Doe's words trailed off, and he froze in place, his knuckles hovering a fraction of an inch from the door.
"Do you hear that?"
"Hear what?" Hershey asked. He moved his ear closer to the office door. A faint sound could be made out through the muffling of the wood, the sound of someone whistling cheerfully. "So Herring's a music lover. So what?"
"So?"
Doe pursed his lips and began to whistle quietly, matching Herring's melody note for note. After a few bars, he stopped and rapped on the door. Herring's whistling stopped as well. A moment later, the door opened, revealing a 40-ish woman with pale skin and thick lips and round, unblinking eyes. Atop her head was a massive tangle of graying hair so voluminously frizzy Tarzan could swing through it, clinging to stray curls like jungle vines.
"Oh, it's you," the woman said to Hershey with undisguised contempt. "Back for another turn of the thumbscrews, huh? Well, come on in if you really have to."
Hershey and Doe followed her into her office, which was even more packed with bric-a-brac than MacGuffin's.
"You must be Doe, the big detective," Herring said as she took a seat behind her clutter-covered desk.
Doe smiled modestly.
"Well, I am Philo Doe, and I am a detective. Whether or not I'm big, I leave to others to decide."
Herring coughed out a raspy laugh.
"I bet you do."
She reached up and scratched her head, and when her fingers emerged from the thicket of salt-and-pepper locks, they were clasping a cigarette.
"Care to join me?"
Hershey and Doe both shook their heads.
Heron shrugged and lit up her smoke with a lighter she fished from somewhere behind her ear. "So," she said, leaning back and swinging her heels up onto the edge of her desk, revealing a set of surprisingly shapely gams in the process. "Let the Inquisition begin." "I only have a few questions, Dr. Heron," Doe said, "and there will be no thumbscrews, I promise." Heron shrugged. "Suit yourself." "I usually do," Doe replied. "First off, did you have cause to enter the records room yesterday?" "I not only had cause, I did it. I'm in and out of there all day, and so are MacGuffin and Straw." "And at the end of the day, when it comes time to leave, you're searched just like MacGuffin and Straw?" "I wouldn't say just like. I'm guessing Powell's a little more thorough with me. He seems particularly worried that I'm going to sneak something out strapped to my caboose. Ever been groped by a man in uniform, Mr. Doe? Let me tell you, it gets old fast." Doe gave her a cryptic smile. "One more thing, Dr. Herring," he said, and he leaned toward her, his smile instantly replaced by a frowning glower. "How were you wearing your hair when you left yesterday?" Herring gaped at him a moment. "What are you, a detective or a hairdresser?" she finally scoffed. "A person can be many things," Doe responded coolly. "Now, answer the question." "All right." Herring pointed her cigarette at a small cluster of hairpins on her desk. "I had those in. My hair was in a bun. That's how I wear it when I'm outside." She ran the fingers of her left hand through her tresses, and a pencil, some paper clips, a wad of chewing gum, and a heavy dusting of dandruff fell from her bushy locks onto her desk. "I only let my hair down here in the office." "I see," Doe said. "Well, thank you for your time, Doctor. Let's go, Hershey." Herring didn't quite slam the door behind them, but she did close it quickly and firmly, missing their butts by only the tiniest fraction of an inch. Doe lingered for a moment outside the door, listening intently. "The good doctor doesn't appear to be in a whistling mood any longer," he said. "So? What was the big deal about her whistling in the first place?" Doe shook his head at Hershey, looking both saddened and disappointed, like a teacher who spots a student picking his nose in class. "Really, Hershey, how are you supposed to protect America from communists when you don't even recognize their fight song when you hear it?" "Their what?" "The Internationale, Hershey, the official anthem of the Communist Party." Doe whistled the turgid tune they'd heard coming from Herring's office a few minutes before. "Not exactly Cole Porter, is it?" Doe said. "Perhaps that's why you didn't recognize it. It's hardly your hit parade material." Down the hallway behind them, the phone on Powell's desk began to ring. The burly MP scooped up the receiver. "Mandelbaum, thin and puny, clothing the runty man since 1931. Mandelbaum speaking. How may I help you?" Powell's slightly bored expression shifted quickly to surprise.
"Well, why, yes. This is actually a secret government lab."
"Yeah, Philo Doe is here."
"Uh-huh. Okay. I'll pass that along.
My pleasure."
"Right. The same to you. And, sir,
don't ever call here again."
Powell hung up the phone and turned toward Doe.
"A Mr. Furman just called. He left a message for you." "Good heavens, man, you've done it again. Your powers of observation are positively supernatural."
Doe gave a modest shrug. "There's nothing supernatural about it. When one spends a lifetime accumulating and cataloging information, one simply acquires a certain..."
"Hold on, Doe, hold on," Hershey spluttered. "All that stuff about the International, are you saying Herring's a red?"
"Perhaps," Doe said, "or she used to be, or she has unusually bad taste in music. It's suggestive, that's all. Communist sympathies would provide a motive for stealing the blueprints, but then again, so would a simple bribe. I wager the KGB isn't so doctrinaire it doesn't recognize the persuasive power of cold, hard cash. No, it's the means, not the motive, that holds the key to this affair. Now come along. It's time we spoke with Dr. Straw." The man who answered the knock on Straw's door would have made a perfect customer for Mandelbaum's Thin and Puny, if such a store actually existed. He was only slightly taller and broader than your average lawn jockey, and he had to bend back to look up at Doe and Hershey, the way they would have had to crane their necks to see the top of the Empire State Building. He almost could have been mistaken for a child if he didn't have a smoldering pipe sticking from one side of his mouth.
"Well, if it isn't my favorite G-man," Straw said, his voice a surprisingly resonant basso profundo. "Back so soon, and you've brought a friend along, the great Philo Doe, perhaps?"
Straw stretched a tiny hand up over his head, and Doe reached down and took it. "Indeed," Doe said as they shook. "If you don't mind, I have a few questions for you, Dr. Straw."
"Of course. Come on in."
Straw's office was substantially tidier than his colleagues, partially because the furniture took up far less space. The desk and chairs and bookcases were all built to fit Straw's tiny proportions. The only bit of clutter in the room was a half-eaten pastrami sandwich and a kosher dill sitting on a crumpled bed of wax paper on one corner of the desk. Doe wedged himself into one of the Lilliputian seats, his knees almost bumping into his chest. Hershey chose to stay on his feet. "So tell me, Doctor," Doe began. His long, thin nose twitched like a rabbit's, and the old detective seemed to lose his train of thought.
"Yes," Straw said.
"Did you...
go into the records room yesterday?" Doe asked, taking a discreet whiff with each pause.
"I did. I went in to look over the plans for the MacGuffin device. I've been working on the..." Straw shot a quick glance up at Hershey, then chuckled softly. "I guess I shouldn't say, but the Chicago project is a team effort, and everyone's got their own little field of expertise, including me. Only Professor MacGuffin really understands the thing as a whole. I've been thinking about some alterations I was going to propose to him, and I wanted to look the plans over one more time before doing my final calculations."
"And did you?" Doe asked, still sniffing at the air.
"No, as it turns out. Dr. Herring was already going over the blueprints, and I didn't want to disturb her. I figured I could just come back some other time." Straw shrugged his tiny shoulders. "I guess I was wrong."
"Was Herring wearing her hair up or down?"
"Gosh, I don't know. Dr. Herring's hair isn't something I pay much attention to be honest." Straw sucked on his pipe for a moment, looking thoughtful. "Down, I guess."
"Ah," Doe said, nodding absent-mindedly. He took in one more deep whiff, then smiled broadly. "Of course, anchovies."
"What?" Straw and Hershey asked simultaneously.
"I've been trying to identify a scent I picked up when we walked into this room," Doe explained. "It was obscured by the smoke from Dr. Straw's pipe, but now I have it. Salt-cured fish, anchovies to be precise. Doctor, am I correct in thinking that the pizza that was delivered here yesterday ended up in your office?"
Straw gave an astonished nod. "That's right, I took the pizza. Turns out I'm the only one around here who enjoys anchovies. That's quite a nose you've got, Mr. Doe."
"For the true gourmand, smell is at least as important as a sense of taste."
"Hold on," Hershey barked. "Straw, are you saying that you ate that commie pizza?" "Absolutely," Straw declared with chest-swelling pride. "I figured if somebody was out to poison us, they would have sent us a pizza with pepperoni and mushrooms or sausage and green peppers, toppings people like. The pineapple and anchovies were just to taunt us, and I wasn't going to let some Boris or Ivan put one over on me. No, sir."
The diminutive scientist pushed back his chair and climbed up onto his desk.
"They say we're in a cold war with these Bolshevik bums," he went on, his deep voice booming.
He stared up over Doe and Hershey's heads, as if watching a fireworks display, or an eagle in flight, or bombs bursting in air while our flag was still there.
"Well, if I'd been too scared to eat that pizza, then the Reds would have already won. So I took it home, and I had it for dinner. And friends, let me tell you something. That pizza tasted like America to me. It tasted like Mom and apple pie and baseball. It tasted like amber waves of grain. It tasted like freedom, and damn it, it was delicious."
By the time Straw was done, Hershey looked like he was about to salute.
"Yes, by God," the CIA agent said, wiping a tear from his eye. "What could taste better than a heaping plate of piping hot liberty?"
"You stepped on your sandwich," Doe added.
Straw began wiping his foot off on the edge of his desk. "So there you are, gentlemen," he said. "Any more questions?"
"Just one." Doe leaned forward, glaring at Straw melodramatically. He stretched out his long, thin arm and pointed at the bottom of the scientist's shoe.
"What is that?"
Pastrami," Straw said.
"Yes, but it's more than that, isn't it, Doctor? It's much, much more."
Straw flashed Hershey a quick, confused look that asked, "Is this guy senile?" Hershey just shrugged. "It's pastrami on rye," Straw said, "with a pickle."
Doe nodded. "And?"
"It's my lunch?"
"Exactly," Doe proclaimed.
He turned toward Hershey, a look of smug satisfaction stretching his wrinkle-creased features.
Hershey stared back at him as if he had an Airedale on his head. Doe's gloating collapsed into a sigh.
"Means, Hershey, means," he said. "MacGuffin, Herring, Dr. Straw here, even the guards, they're all searched when they leave this facility. So how could the plans be sneaked out? Why, in something no one would want to touch or examine too closely. Beneath a Scotsman's kilt, for instance, or tucked away in a voluminous head of dandruffy hair. But if MacGuffin wasn't wearing his kilt yesterday, and Herring had her hair pinned up when she left, that leaves..."
Hershey's brow was so furrowed his forehead almost bumped his nose.
Doe sighed again.
"I couldn't bring myself to so much as touch it,"
the old detective said, imitating Professor MacGuffin's oatmeal-thick brogue. He turned toward Straw and shook his head sadly.
"Really, Doctor, no one likes anchovies on pizza. No one."
"I do," Straw protested.
"Enough to eat an entire pizza all by yourself? Stand it on end and an extra large would be taller than you."
"I didn't say I finished it."
"Then where are the leftovers? All true connoisseurs will tell you pizza's just as good the next day. Some say even better."
Doe nodded at the mangled pastrami on rye.
"Yet you bought your lunch from a deli today. Why would that be necessary if you had a refrigerator full of pizza at home?"
"I ate too much of it. It made me sick."
Yet here you are at work, looking remarkably well. Perhaps it was the pastrami and the pickle that settled your stomach, eh?" Doe shook his head and chuckled. "No, I think not. The truth is, Doctor, you couldn't hide the blueprints on your person. You don't have enough person on which to hide anything. But you could hide the plans under an extra-large pizza, especially if it was sure to disgust anyone who so much as glanced at it. So your KGB handlers sent in the pizza, and you brought out the plans." Straw clenched his little fists in impotent rage. In the blink of an eye, his expression changed from incredulous to defiant. "You don't have any proof, old man," he sneered. "You'll never find the blueprints, and you'll never be able to pin the theft on me." "Oh, I beg to differ," Doe replied calmly. "When you hid the plans beneath a double anchovy and pineapple pizza, you no doubt created the stinkiest blueprints in the history of drafting. All we need to do now is procure the services of any reasonably competent tracking dog. Why, with a trail of anchovies, cheese, and diced pineapple to follow, I could probably sniff out the trail." With a feral roar, Straw launched himself at Doe's throat. Before Doe could so much as gasp, Hershey stretched out a hand, snatched Straw out of the air, and tucked the tiny traitor under his arm like a football. "Why'd you do it, Doc?" Hershey asked. "How could you sell us out to the commies?" "That MacGuffin, naming the device after himself when all of us helped build it," Straw ranted, kicking his feet like a child throwing a tantrum. "He thinks he's so big. Someone had to cut him down to size." "Let me tell you something, Doc," Hershey said, shaking his head. "There's nothing smaller than a man who betrays his own country." Straw went as limp as a rag doll and began weeping quietly. "Nicely put, Hershey," Doe said. "Now I suppose we'd best—" There was a firm knock on the office door. "Yeah, what?" Hershey called out. The door swung open and Powell leaned into the room. "Pardon me for interrupting, sirs," the MP said. He paused for only a fraction of a second upon catching sight of Straw wedged under Hershey's armpit. "This just came from Mr. Doe." He handed Doe a Western Union telegram and backed quickly out of the room. "Astonishing, Doe, stop," the telegram read. "Your powers of deduction are as sharp as ever, stop. America can sleep easier tonight knowing you're still ready to heed the call to duty, stop. Sincerely, Cy Furman." "Really, Doe, how does he do that?" asked Hershey, who'd read the message over Doe's shoulder. Doe brushed the question aside with a wry shrug. "I'll sleep easier tonight knowing the Soviet Union will never have its own H-bomb," he said. "Now, let's go get those plans." And that's exactly what they did. One of New York's finest police dogs led them from the underground lab to Straw's apartment to a KGB front bakery in Little Italy, where a Soviet spymaster-slash-pastrymaker was about to smuggle the blueprints out of the country folded and baked into a pumpkin pie. So MacGuffin got back the plans, Hershey got the spies, the dog got the pie, Straw got the chair, and Doe got to ease back into retirement with one more victory on his impressive roster of cases solved. And the rest of us got something, too. The government quickly established a new security protocol for all federal offices and installations. Any pizzas brought in or out had to be round and pre-cut by at least four intersecting radial lines. That way, all a guard had to do was lift up one slice to see all the way to the middle, thus ensuring that nothing could be smuggled underneath. These newfangled pizza pies caught on with civil servants, and soon they were ordering them even when they weren't at work. The practice spread to their family and friends, and through them to the rest of the country, and before long the sliced circle pizza fad was sweeping the globe. Today, of course, square pizza is rare, and you'll only find unsliced pizza in the frozen food aisle. The pizza pie reigns supreme as perhaps the most popular culinary dish in the world, but some of us, historians, gourmets, collectors of antique food, remember the way it used to be, and that we have a man named Philo Doe to thank for changing it all. Bert hadn't been able to get much rest while Raymond told his story. For once, he wasn't just incredulous, he was furious. As Bert saw it, he and Raymond had an unspoken covenant. Raymond could go on whatever flights of fancy he wanted as long as he didn't insult Bert's intelligence. And this square pizza Philo Doe MacGuffin device story crossed the line. It didn't just insult Bert's intelligence, it spat in its face, kicked it in the groin, and called its mama dirty names. It was an extra-large serving of malarkey with a generous topping of balderdash and a side order of B.S., and Bert was going to say so. Just as he opened his mouth to speak, the waitress returned. "One extra large, need anything else? No? Okay, enjoy," she mumbled quickly, tossing the pizza on the table frisbee fashion before turning and dashing for the safety of the kitchen. Having once been trapped in the black hole strength gravity generated by Raymond's mouth, she obviously had no intention of being sucked in again. Bert looked down at the pizza, which was spinning like a roulette wheel on the table before him. No, he realized as it slowed to a stop, not like a wheel at all. The pizza was square, and it was unsliced, just like in Raymond's story. And there was something else odd about it. Every inch was covered with heaps of small, brown, leathery-looking strips. The pizza had been topped with an entire school of anchovies. "No one likes anchovies on pizza," Philo Doe had said. "No one."
and that part of the story Bert had almost been willing to believe. To him, anchovies were about as appetizing as a deep-fried jockstrap. Yet there was Raymond, peeling off a particularly long string of fish and dropping it into his mouth. He chewed, smiling, then licked his fingers before grabbing a corner of the pizza and tearing it off. "Ah, the food of the gods," Raymond said with a satisfied sigh. He began rolling the pizza scrap up, and sauce and cheese and grease and bits of fish oozed out to coat his fingers. Bert moaned and put his head down on the table. Facing a ninja death squad had been easy. Watching Raymond mangle pizza classico with anchovies, that was hard. "You know why they call them anchovies, don't you?" Raymond said, the speaking of words doing absolutely nothing to slow his chewing of food. "They're named for the woman who first farmed them commercially, anchovy. In the wild, they used to be known as Fetus salsus pisciculus, or more commonly, the salty little pisher fish. Ferocious creatures. Make piranha look like goldfish. It's pretty amazing how Chovy domesticated them, actually. The fish whisperer, people called her." And on Raymond went, not pausing until half the pizza was gone, and Bert had picked up the bill, as always. Bert didn't eat a bite except for a nibble at a breadstick and a half-hearted attempt at calming his queasy stomach. When the waitress boxed up the leftovers and tried to give them to him, he nearly passed out. "No," he managed to gasp, pointing at Raymond. "Him." "Goody," his friend said, giving the waitress a cheerful wink as she handed him the box. "More for me." And that, beyond a doubt, was true.
That was Steve Hawkinsmith reading his story, The MacGuffin Theft Case, from the November 2005 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. This recording was produced with the help of Emily Giuliano and Jackie Sherbo. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, which is published by Dell Magazines. Look for Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine at your newsstand, or you can download issues to read on your e-readers through Amazon.com, Sony eBook Store, BarnesandNoble.com, and FictionWise.com. You can learn more about us online at www.themysteryplace.com.